Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, on the 70th anniversary of the Allied invasion of the beaches at Normandy, WOSU's Steve Brown spoke with one veteran who was there. He'll share his memories of that day in 1944. We'll also take a look back at Springfield's radio heyday, and Community Voices producer Basim Blunt tells us about the power of poetry to change lives. Up first, as we reported last week, accidental overdoses, including those caused by heroin, continue to rise in Ohio and in Montgomery County. This past week, a local nonprofit joined in the fight to turn those numbers around. On Wednesday evening, East End Community Services trained local residents how to administer an overdose medicine, naloxone, which interrupts the effects of heroin or morphine overdose. I spoke with Amanda Arrington with East End about their efforts.
You know, East End Community Services does a wide array of programs and activities for families, a lot of youth programming. We even tear down and build new houses. We've done a lot of community development in East Dayton. We have right now a Department of Justice grant to look at crime prevention and crime reduction. And when we started doing this work with the Dayton Police Department, we have high levels of theft, for example. We have other crimes. And when you start to look at, well, what drives that type of crime? We found overwhelming drug addiction, drug use, people desperate to avoid withdrawal, that they're breaking into cars or breaking into homes or prostitution, for example. And so when you start, you know, kind of peeling back the onion, well, what's needed? What's necessary? So this is really out of our realm, to be perfectly honest, for East End. We're not a treatment center. We don't do substance abuse counseling. We make referrals, but we're really kind of jumping into this whole opiate overdose epidemic that we have. And when I heard about the Project Dawn training, which Dawn is for deaths avoided with naloxone, and I heard that not very many kits had gone out, even though Adamus, our local alcohol, drug, and mental health board, pays for it. There's funding for it. It's free of charge. We could be saving lives. I said, well, what are the barriers? What can we be doing to make it accessible and, you know, get it out into the community and to the families and friends that need it? Anything we can do to save lives. I mean, there are overdose death memos that come across my email every week. And it's certainly depressing, but it's a crisis, in my opinion, that we need to all be doing something to avert.
You're getting this to the front lines where people right. can actually prevent overdoses.
Absolutely. We want to make sure people realize that, you know, if their spouse is using, if their son or daughter is struggling with an addiction. Now, it is just for opiate and heroin. Again, this is not my expertise, but I understand if someone has an addiction to something else, like meth or cocaine or any other class of drugs, this will not work. It doesn't help. But then again, it's this group of drugs, opiates, pain pill addictions, the heroin addiction that is causing the overdose. You know, you don't hear about deaths from you know, crack or marijuana use. It's you know, this particular issue, you know, that this Project Dawn training is designed for. And if we, you know, can get the kit into the hands of folks who may be there when they find their loved one or their friend unresponsive, it's a nasal mist. So we've had lots of questions about that. It's not an injection. There's Narcan, there's naloxone, there's lots of different things out there. But this one will be a kit with a nasal mist that you just squirt into the nose, but you still must call 911. It'll only buy you extra time. You know, I think they said between 30 minutes to 90 minutes maybe, and we still need to get them to the hospital.
You said this was new territory for East End, so I'm wondering, did you go into it with a little bit of trepidation?
Sure, good question. We at East End, we had some conversations because certainly when you talk about drug addiction and drug use, you know, there are folks, you know, in different camps, you know, some who are angry and frustrated and think that the person needs to be held accountable and you know, if they have, you know, committed theft, for example, that they need to be arrested and you know, go down that path. And there are others that see this as, you know, a medical issue, that we need to come at it from, you know, a sense of compassion, still hold them accountable for any mistakes they might have made in their life or bad choices, but it, recognize that this is a medical, biological, psychological, you know, issue that we can't arrest our way out of. And what can we do to help connect the community with resources, which is ultimately what our mission always is. So even if we can't do something directly, provide a program, we want to always be connecting neighbors and families to that resource.
Amanda Arrington with East End Community Services in Dayton. She says out of the 50 naloxone kits that were available Wednesday night, only 27 were given out. But if even one life is saved as a result, Arrington said, the effort was worth it. This past week, a protest at Walmart on York Commons Boulevard on Wednesday was part of a week of protests and employee walkouts at Walmart stores around the country. Local workers and supporters of a living wage increase by the retail giant were joined by State Representative Connie Pillage of the 28th District. She believes an across-the-board wage boost would help struggling families.
Yeah, we're talking about living wage. We're making sure that people at Walmart and other places in Ohio can earn enough money and get enough work hours so they can support their families. Walmart, as you might know, is Ohio's leading employer, but it's also Ohio's leading employer with employees on Medicaid and food stamps. And that's rather disappointing. And in this kind of economy that we have right now, if people are working and they want to work full-time, they ought to be able to find a full-time job that pays them a living wage, the kind that can help them provide for their families without depending on public safety net programs like food stamps or Medicaid. So we've been doing a lot of research on this, and a recent report indicates that if retailers like Walmart paid their employees $25,000 per year, it could create more than 100,000 jobs and lift over 700,000 people out of poverty. Can you imagine the impact on any given community if hundreds or maybe even thousands of families were no longer on the public dole, no longer reliant on food stamps? They'd have more money in their pockets. Not only would they feel better about taking care of themselves and their families, but they'd be able to make ends meet. They'd be able to have a little more money to spend, and maybe they could even start saving for a rainy day or saving for retirement. It would just have an incredible impact on our communities and improve our economy. Having a living wage is extremely important for women who are the sole or co-breadwinners in the majority of American households today. They need to maximize their income potential because so many people rely on them. They have, you know, husbands, they have families, they have children, they have parents, perhaps other extended family that they have to help support. So when we make things better for women, we make things better for working families all across Ohio. So if we've been talking about equal pay a lot in the legislature and across the state, and I got to tell you, everywhere I go in Ohio, I see people working twice as hard but getting only half as far. And if we could help them just by making sure they get equal pay, it would have such an impact on their families. And we just really owe it to Ohio families to make sure that they get paid a living wage, that they're not being discriminated against for unfair reasons, and that they have a chance to move ahead. And now here at Walmart, we see many of their employees have low wages, part-time work, and erratic scheduling. And that's very hard on women and their families. It hurts them, it hurts their families, and it does hurt our economy.
Unfortunately, we have an economy that seems to be creating more part-time and lower entry jobs instead of higher-paying full-time jobs, and that's not particular to Ohio. But when you talk about living wage and raising the minimum wage for places like Walmart, that certainly might be a reasonable request, but then there are also small businesses that would be affected by that, and it would eat into their hiring power. Do you see a distinction between the larger businesses like Walmart and smaller businesses?
Well, let me just tell you this. I understand exactly what you're saying, but we have real world cases where the minimum wage was raised in isolation from other parts of the country. And what we ended up seeing, instead of it hurting businesses, it actually helped businesses because it put more money into the pockets of their employees. And oftentimes when people are at the lower end of the income scale, they turn around and spend that money immediately into the local economy, which generates more business and more demand for all the businesses in the local community. And so actually the economic activity increased, and it was good for the community. So that I think that would have a positive effect. You know what? Look, I started my life in the military, and people are everything to the military mission. You don't get to choose who works for you. The people are assigned to you. You have men and women. And as an officer, my job was to get the best performance out of everyone. And I learned from the examples set by my fabulous commanders that I got to work for that if you treat your people with respect and dignity, they will work hard for you.
State Representative Connie Pillage of Ohio's 28th District commenting on a Walmart protest that took place this past Wednesday. The City of Dayton's First Friday is an event that opens up downtown art galleries and businesses to draw in visitors. But this week brought bad news for one downtown gallery. The Connecting Art and Design Community, formerly known as the Cannery Gallery, is shutting its doors at the end of the month. Christy Genowin heads the gallery and event space. She says the gallery has struggled with funding.
People won't come downtown for some reason. So some of the people in the suburbs that have great, you know, homes to put art into maybe may not come down to see us.
First Fridays help promote art spaces downtown, but Genowin says revenue from sales and events hasn't added up. But she says it's not just her gallery. She's been in downtown Dayton 9 years and probably seen 10 galleries come and go. Connecting Art and Design is considering joining forces with K-12, another downtown arts organization, to house its 20 or so member artists. The organization is having a moving sale through the end of June. The local radio stations that once flourished in Clark County have been gone for almost 25 years, but they've not been forgotten. As WISO's Wayne Baker reports, the Clark County Historical Society recently hosted an event that took a look back.
Cox Media journalist Daryl Bauer emceed the event that covered Springfield's radio heyday, the 1920s through the 1990s. Five stations dominated the airwaves, playing everything from Christian programming to soul music. Former radio personalities were on hand to share with the audience stories about Jonathan Winters and Rod Serling, who both were behind the mic in Springfield. Dick Hatfield was one of the top DJs in the 1960s. He played a few audio clips from that era.
It was very difficult recording anything back then. It was done mainly on records, big records, 16-inch records. And I have the opening and close of a basketball game recorded in 1950. It's the night that Springfield High School won the state basketball championship. And it took 11 16-inch records to record this game. Here's the opener.
This is Bob Crystal speaking for Garrigan. This evening, direct from the Coliseum at the State Fairgrounds in Columbus, you'll hear the final game in the Class A state basketball tournament between Springfield High School and Akron South. Ray Schwartz is here to tell you a little about the teams and keep you posted on statistics.
Now, this third station came to being around 1947, late WJEL. It was coupled also with WJEM-FM. And we have one of the most unusual things about this station, and Bill will coincide this fact, one of their first announcers was Rod Serling. He was going to Antioch College. He graduated, and he was still working at WJEL, which at that time was located in the Columbia building at the corner of Columbia, and the building is still there, catty corner from the old Hume Hotel. And it was while he was at WJEL that he entered one of his manuscripts to a contest being held by CBS in New York, and he won. And that was his catapult to national fame in radio and television broadcasting. From downtown Springfield, JEL, all the way over to New York in the big time. There was another disc jockey. This was used by Norm Guerin, who was officially the Wise Owl. He used to broadcast from the Esquire Grill downtown at night. So let's see what you think about this one. Booner J. Soccer. He once called a local pharmacy and with that Hooner J. Soccer voice, and told the pharmacist that his missus had been there and bought some of that Kentucky jelly. He said, at least that's what they thought it was, because it said KY on it. She brought it home, and he said, I just want you to know, sir, that stuff tastes terrible on toast. Smiling Bob wraps up the old ball of yarn around here, Mama. Bob Jantz was probably the most prolific in radio for the years that he spent in it. And he has, this is honest God's truth, on his tombstone at Calvary, it raised letters across the bottom, "See you later, alligator." That's no kidding. Now I'm going to play a commercial from 1977 for you.
Hey, how about a little fun?
Okay.
All right, close your eyes. Now, taste this.
Delicious.
You bet it is. You're tasting Riverdale Dairy's Butter Brickle Ice Cream.
How come Riverdale Dairy ice cream tastes better than other ice creams?
The difference is Riverdale Dairy uses pure cane sugar. No imitation. And that's something every family should know.
How come you know so much about Riverdale Dairy products?
Because once you're a Riverdale Dairy kid, you never forget.
When I was in radio, April Fool Day always brought about a likelihood to have some fun. And the first time we tried something, we started announcing early in the morning that Ohio Bell was going to blow all the dirt out of the telephone lines in Springfield. And if you didn't want that soil to get in your house, you should remove the phone from the cradle and wrap it in a damp towel. And this is honest guy's truth. And enough people did that that it tied up telephone service in Springfield, and the police and the fire department came out and said, call it off, you got to stop it. So we had to retract that. Hey, it's all done. Everything's fine. So I'm going to sign off here, guy, and we'll go down the line. Should I give you a sign off?
Yes.
WBLY, concluding another day of broadcast activity. Until we return to the air, this is Dick Hatfield reminding you, if you go out this evening, take a bath and wear clean underwear, you might get hit by a car.
There are no stations operating in Springfield now. WEEC still calls Springfield home, but the station moved its operations to Xenia after merging with Dayton's WFCJ. Wayne Baker, WYSO.
John McEnany. What a beautiful day in Springfield, Ohio today.
Well, it's been 70 years since Allied troops stormed the beaches of Normandy, France, for what many historians call the most important event of the 20th century. Wendell Ellenwood grew up in southern Ohio and attended Ohio State University before enlisting. He spoke with WOSU's Steve Brown about that fateful day in 1944.
We were in England waiting to go across the channel. And we were waiting for the first wave to clean up enough space so we could get the tanks in, because I was in the new Third Army, which was mostly armor, and we needed space to operate. And the hedgerow country there was not the place to do that. So we had to wait till they got a little space cleared out, and that was about time we got to St. Lo, which was, 2-3 weeks later, and then we were committed.
What did the beach look like at the time you got there?
A mess. Well, of course, we had all the ships with their anti-aircraft balloons over them to keep off whatever Nazi planes were still left. But it was a mess. They were trying to get the wharf fixed up It had been damaged by the wind and the waves, and we were still wading in, and we did get some of our armored vehicles in close enough where they could take off, and that was a long time ago.
Long time ago. And you got there a few days after D-Day, a day when thousands of Americans lost their lives. Was morale still high at that time?
Not very, no. A lot of people were talking about getting a million-dollar wound that would get them out of there and back to England. It was tough to go in and see all these dead bodies floating around in the water. But on the other hand, too, people weren't giving up or anything like that. Then I remember shortly after we landed that we ran into a group of French kids, and they brought out some fresh eggs for us, which we hadn't seen for a long time, and I traded them some black bread, which they hadn't seen for a long time. And then we sat around and sang the Marseillaise. And that kind of put things in their place, and we were headed down the highway, which was strewn with burned-out vehicles on each side.
What's your lasting impression of D-Day and of your time afterwards, and I guess all of your time in Europe in general? What do you, if you had to sum it up in a short statement, what would you say?
Well, war is hell. When you see a tank being hit and somebody on fire coming out of there, then somebody ready to take a machine gun to anybody that did get out, it was not a pretty sight. But we had a job to do. I guess we did.
Wendell Ellenwood is a World War II veteran who went on to earn his master's degree from Ohio State University, worked for the federal government, and is the former director of the Ohio Student Union. He now lives in Dublin. Mr. Ellenwood, thanks for your time.
Thank you, and good luck.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, public radio for the Miami Valley. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Basim Blunt joined WYSO as a member of the 2012 Community Voices program. His work has earned him a New Voices Scholar Award by AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio. He also produced the award-winning documentary Boogie Nights, a history of funk music in Dayton. You might know him as WYSO's newest music host on Friday nights Behind the Groove. Today, Basim tells us about the power of poetry.
They say it takes a village to raise a child. Well, that can be said for our village here in Yellow Springs. I was at the gym one day when I met Donna. She told me about some of the challenges her daughter, Erin, was facing as a new teacher. Erin graduated from Yellow Springs High School, and she now teaches fourth grade in San Antonio, Texas. Donna shared with me that her daughter has sent a poem from one of her students named Kyle, a young kid who faced some pretty harsh and challenging situations in his community and at home. But through a poetry assignment at school, he began to open up about some of the experiences he lived through. Poetry had been a way to unlock the spark that every teacher wants to see in a student. Donna had sent me a copy. I was so moved by the simple, elegant truth and honesty that this fourth grader was able to share with words on paper. So I decided to share Kyle's poem with some of my friends and colleagues here at WISO, and we put a little TLC to it and set it to music. And then I sent it back to Kyle's teacher, and she played it in front of the whole class. So today on Why So Weekend, I'd like to share it with you. I am bad and good at the same time. I wonder if my life will be any better. I hear gunfights and firefighters. I see fire trucks going to burning houses. I want the war to stop. I am bad and good at the same time.
I am bad and good at the same time. I pretend I am a soldier. I feel like something is talking to me.
I touch an angel's hand. I worry that the war might never end. I cry for my family. I am bad and good at the same time.
I am bad and good at the same time. I understand that people die every day. I sound crazy. I dream about people who I know and love.
I try to be happy. I hope the war will stop. I am bad and good at the same time. I know I am too young to save my family. I am from a war that never ends.
I live where people die. I can be good. I sometimes try to help people. I am bad and good at the same time.
This week I received an email from Kyle. It reads, "Thank you for putting all your hard work into the poem. I felt kind of bashful but happy. I think I'm going to be a great poet. In the future, this will inspire me to share my poems with the world. Thank you, Kyle."
The Power of Poetry from Community Voices producer Basim Blunt on Why So Weekend.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the second week of early summer. I have recently paid attention to the fact that my solitude is always an accompanied solitude. Last year, I took part in several group walking meditation sessions in the woods. During these walks, I found that I was flooded with images from the season, also with associated images of people I once knew, and events evoked by the trees and plants. And I realized that the group experience only compounded another type of experience, that of being accompanied by other inhabitants of the landscape of my mind. Rarely, in fact, do I walk alone. I find that that is especially true as I navigate the house and garden where I lived with my wife for many decades. As I watch myself watching, I keep coming back to the idea that place is only partially a matter of geography. It is also a matter of imagination. And I feel that the fusion of inner and outer landscape creates a powerful web, a web of sensory impressions, recollection, reminiscence, association, emotion, and rumination of and about people, habitats, and events. Now, all of those images offer challenges to meditation, but not to rumination. Instead of allowing the images to pass through my consciousness, instead of finding a safe, empty, meditative space, I pay attention to my imaginary companions now, and I find them everywhere, sometimes guiding me, sometimes talking to me, sometimes reminding me or keeping me company, sometimes coming into bright relief, and sometimes lying vague and ghostly at the back of my mind, peopling the landscape with story. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the third week of early summer. In the meantime, think about your inner and your outer landscape and the people who inhabit both of them.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this week's edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org, a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks again for joining us. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.